Good morning. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land and pay my respects to elders past and present. Thank you so much to the Kazatan Centre for inviting me to come along and speak today. And I also would like to thank you for accommodating my many requests for changes. I do apologise and thank you so much for accommodating me this morning. The title of my talk today is on terrorism, counter-terrorism and human rights. And what I'd like to do is explore a little bit the role of human rights and how we address human rights in meeting the challenges of both terrorism and counter-terrorism in today's day and age. So I think most people in this room would be familiar with the old adage of one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. And that phrase is often attributed to Gerald Seymour's 1975 novel called Harry's Game, which was about the Northern Ireland conflict. But the phrase itself has actually been used in various forms before then, and indeed since then has been applied to various conflicts around the world. It's a phrase that encapsulates the very challenge of finding a common, universal definition of terrorism, a challenge that has plagued the international community now for several years. The term terrorism is so subjective that how it's defined most often comes down to perception or a point of view, often a judgment that is both morally and politically laden. But the phrase also underscores something very different. It underscores the competing claims to human rights that both sides in a conflict assert: the right to life, liberty, and security, the right to freedom of movement and residence within borders, the right to nationality and self-determination, the right to freedom of thought and religion, the right to freedom of expression, the right to political participation. While terrorist actors often lay claims to their own rights and freedoms, for example, anti-colonialists, during the anti-colonial wave of terrorism, will lay claim to their rights with regards to nationality and self-determination. But governments and agencies charged with protecting their people must also necessarily lay claim to the rights and freedoms of their citizens to liberty and security. So as such, the prime objectives of counter-terrorism are twofold and expressed dually as being, first of all, to undermine and decimate the violence of terrorist actors and, at the same time, ensure the security and safety of citizens. The United States National Security Strategy, for example, states that as a part of its responsibility for protecting the American people, the government will, among other things, prevent the spread and use of weapons of mass destruction, reinforce homeland security, and take decisive action against terrorist actors. Australia's counter-terrorism approach takes a similar stance, basing our national security strategy on the protection of lives as an absolute priority through disrupting terrorist activity. Ultimately, the end goal of any counter-terrorism strategy should be to seek an end to violence. In cases where actions taken by governments against terrorist actors include collective punishment and reprisals against entire groups of citizens, either its own citizens or citizens of another state, counter-terrorism fails and often ends up as part of a cycle of violence with the potential to descend into civil war and ongoing conflict in failed states. And we've certainly seen examples of this throughout history. In my book, Terrorism and Global Security, I make the point that terrorism is certainly not new and indeed has been part of the human condition for centuries. From the Sicarii in the 1st century to the Ismaili Nizaris, better known as the Assassins in the 13th century, to the anarchists, the anti-colonialists and separatists, the New Left, and the current wave, widely and broadly referred to as the religious wave of terrorism. So terrorism is by no means a static phenomenon. It's one that's transformed in response to global events and trends, among them globalization and the technological revolution. So too, our response to terrorism needs to be equally agile, equally adaptive, and equally able to respond effectively to the threat of violence against innocent civilians. And part of this is recognizing that the contemporary threat of terrorism goes beyond a real and present danger of violent acts, both at home and abroad. In his address to Congress shortly after the 9/11 attacks on the United States, then President George Bush defined those attacks as what he called a new kind of war, one that extended beyond previously established borders of combat to uncharted battlefields of ideological warfare. 5 years later, on the anniversary of the attacks, Bush reaffirmed these so-called new boundaries of what was then dubbed the War on Terror, stating that, I quote, "The war against this enemy is more than a military conflict. It is the decisive ideological struggle of the 21st century and the calling of our generation." But from the very first declaration of war, and despite then the recognition of the part that ideology played, it was very clear that the 9/11 terrorist attacks in 2001 would instigate the conditions for a militarized response. As the world watched the capture and demise of Osama bin Laden some 10 years after the terrorist attacks, scholars reasonably argued that the prolonged war on terror failed to eradicate the threat of international terrorism. This hard power approach of war on terror might have succeeded in decimating the operational and tactical capacity of Al-Qaeda proper, but the belief that the destruction of training camps would successfully eradicate Al-Qaeda's affiliates and its ideology was misplaced. The conventional wisdom of employing an orthodox military response against an unorthodox enemy whose regenerative capacity relies on its ability to employ soft strategies of influence and mobilization has rightly been questioned. Today's terrorist acts don't have to be directed by any group, for example, Daesh. They are, in fact, more often inspired by them. So the so-called war on terror, the terminology of the war on terror and the concept of a war on terror was co-opted and reconstructed by Al-Qaeda and its affiliates as a war on Islam. And that provided a powerful rally cry to potential recruits and sympathizers. The belief that war on terror was code for a carefully constructed attempt to undermine global Islam is no longer limited to conspiracy theorists and 9/11 truth seekers. Instead, it's become a very pillar, a very staple, upon which a global violent jihadist movement has built a powerful narrative that appeals to disconnected and disparate Muslims around the world. It lays exclusive claim to the right to freedom of belief, a claim that resonates and regenerates in the minds of individuals in free and democratic states like Australia. Individuals who, for no understandable reason, have no substantial cause that we can comprehend for feeling that their rights have been violated to the extent that they feel personally mobilized to take up arms for the protection of those rights. And among Muslims who interpreted jihad as a call to duty in defense of Islam, but who may not have supported the use of violence during peaceful times, the war on Islam was an instant and effective justification for taking up armed conflict. In 2010, the Obama administration finally took a strategic decision to change the way that they talked about the war on terror, announcing that they were not at war with jihadists, with Islam, or indeed with terror. Instead of the war on terror, the Obama administration started referring to the war on Al-Qaeda, referring to specifically Al-Qaeda as the enemy and Al-Qaeda's Muslim victims as its friends and allies. This new terminology reflected a much needed change and a long neglected understanding and recognition of the importance of language and perception in counter-terrorism. And the attempt to shift the language on the war on terror, though, came too late. The task of undoing a decade of damage done by a prolonged military campaign requires more than just a shift in the language of war. So subsequently, what we have today is that governments around the world have to contend with the reality of the dilemma that now presents itself in the form of what has been variously dubbed as a war for hearts and minds and a battle of ideas. And that dilemma, I believe, is not how do we protect the rights of our citizens to safety and security with or without compromising the fundamental human rights of freedom of belief and religion and freedom of expression. This, I believe, is the basis of claims made by some conservative groups who argue that political correctness has infringed on their rights to freedom of expression by preventing them from criticising Islam. This argument constructs a false dichotomy, a duality, that the rights and freedoms of speech and expression and the rights to security and liberty are somehow at odds with the rights associated with freedom of belief. But in a liberal democratic society, all rights should be pursued with vigour. Counter-terrorism should not be reduced to an agenda of competing rights, no matter how popular or how tempting it might be to respond to legitimate fears and concerns about safety by calling for the limiting of rights and freedoms of certain groups. These kinds of collective responses that call for bans, or even as we've seen more recently, internment camps for Muslims, to us, particularly those in this room, may seem extreme or unthinkable. But we need to remain vigilant to ensure that in times of perceived crisis, the unthinkable doesn't become presented as prudent or even necessary. Freedom of belief is underpinned in our constitution and is the cornerstone of a secular democracy. So we have to ask the question, we have to ask why these fundamental democratic values of human rights and the freedom of belief fail to engage some young people and inoculate them against the violent messaging of Daesh or ISIS or ISIL, whatever you want to call them. I prefer to call them Daesh. The task of counter-terrorism today places equal significance on, first of all, but not necessarily primarily, stopping terrorist acts through activities that are designed to decimate their tactical capabilities to organise, plan and conduct violent acts. And secondly, and equally, on undermining the capacity of terrorist groups to engage, manipulate and mobilise individuals to commit acts of violence. And both hold equal importance for human rights. The first approach to counter-terrorism emphasises an offensive puts emphasis on offensive and punitive actions using instruments of hard power. These include military, intelligence, target hardening and criminal sanctions. The second approach that places emphasis on prevention is often referred to as the soft side of counter-terrorism, or, in bureaucratic speak, countering violent extremism, loosely defined as measures that target the root causes of terrorism at the social, at the societal level. Unlike hard power tactics, soft power measures are much harder to quantify and often take years to implement before any measurable results become evident. And therefore you have this kind of competition between hard and soft power. Hard power proponents argue that it's a swifter and more immediate measure for achieving objectives through coercion, while soft power argue that attraction rather than coercion can be more effective in the long term. But both hard and soft power are much more nuanced than simple definition of coercive versus attraction, because soft instruments can be used in hard ways and vice versa. It is instead more useful to think of hard power as being purposeful in its application and finite in its effect, while soft power can be both purposeful and non-purposeful, and potentially infinite in its effect. Importantly though, neither soft nor hard power alone is very effective in achieving the goals of counter-terrorism. Integrating these two approaches into a single framework that effectively balances hard and soft is challenged by the very institutions and contexts which govern each form of power. This kind of integrated framework of soft and hard is what I've previously termed smart counterterrorism, borrowing from the approach taken by to foreign policy taken by the American scholar Joseph Nye. Punitive measures introduced in Australia, Canada, the UK, and elsewhere respond to terrorism in ways that reflect hard power implemented by state institutions and law enforcement agencies. Meanwhile, broad-based intervention and prevention initiatives that have the potential to interrupt radicalisation in the early stages are reliant on the capacity of the non-government sector. This is the machinery of soft power. In a smart counter-terrorism approach, the traditional hard strategies involving military, policing, intelligence, and legislation are insufficient for establishing an effective long-term strategy. But they are not entirely discounted. Rather, hard power measures are used in combination with soft power in ways that effectively respond to the root causes of violent extremism. Smart counterterrorism is achieved through an integrated strategy, a resource base, and a toolkit that draws from both hard and soft power mechanisms. But smart counterterrorism is not simply a matter of balancing hard and soft measures. It's a matter of getting the right balance right. And this is where I want to talk about getting soft measures right. Because soft measures that are based on flawed assumptions that are derivatives of a hard approach often manifest as soft measures being used in hard ways. So since 2003, Australia has attempted to develop its soft power measures in the prevention of what's been called homegrown terrorism. And for the most part, this has been through programs and activities that focus largely on the promotion of Australian or Western values and the integration of Muslim communities into the broader Australian society. And while these initiatives are valuable in their own right and should be valued as such, they've had actually quite limited success in incorporating soft power into a hard power framework to develop a smart integrated framework. I believe that a smarter approach to soft power in counterterrorism can be found in the concept of cohesion, defined as the interrelatedness and unity between individuals, groups, and organisations in society. This encapsulates the willingness to cooperate between individuals, between groups, and importantly, between individuals and social institutions. It also encapsulates civic participation and inclusivity. The OECD looks at social cohesion through three lenses. Social inclusion refers to the degree to which all citizens can participate on equal footing in the economic, social and political life. It includes commitments to equality, but also mutual engagement. Social capital refers to the trust between people and in the institutions, and a sense of belonging to society. And that includes trust in government, in the democratic process, and trust in the institutions of government. And social mobility refers to equality of opportunity to get ahead, and that includes economic freedom. By integrating these three lenses into a counter-terrorism framework in Australia that already incorporates hard power mechanisms, the goal of smart counter-terrorism, based not just on balancing hard and soft power, but also, importantly, effective soft measures, can be achieved. And in going about this task, we should remain cognizant of the traditional tensions between hard and soft power institutions and instruments. In this sense, governments need to think simultaneously about hard and soft strategies and how one might affect the other, as well as recognise their limitations in incorporating soft elements of power that are often outside their sphere of influence and expertise. Since soft power resources generally exist outside the government realm, governments must learn to conduct business in a more fluid, dynamic, and flexible way with smaller, less formal, and less bureaucratic groups. The tools of soft counterterrorism reside in small, adaptable, transnational networks which work towards prevention, intervention, and rehabilitation. In this sense, smart counterterrorism is dependent on harnessing the power of grassroots civil society movements in ways that address the shortcomings of institutionalized power and potentially contribute to building trust between individuals and governing institutions. Perhaps most importantly though, a smart counterterrorism approach addresses the very dilemma posed by the current wave of terrorism for peaceful nations around the world. And I'm afraid that rather than leave you with any kind of solid answers, I may actually leave you with some more questions here. And those questions are, how do we respond to an unconventional enemy for whom our own commitment to human rights is seen as a weakness to exploit? How do we do this without creating a false dichotomy between different rights and freedoms? And how do we, governments, politicians, civil society actors, ensure that challenging terrorism does not become a matter of competing rights? How do we stay true to our commitment to human rights for all our citizens? These are questions that are not easily answered by three-word slogans or populist calls for collective punishment. Smart counterterrorism offers a mechanism for governments and law enforcement to exercise hard power in the prevention of terrorist attacks. But it also accommodates a way for government and civil society actors to participate in long-term prevention aspects of counterterrorism by promoting individual rights through participatory citizenship. And I think I've said enough, so I think we may try and answer some of those questions. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anne. We now have about 15 minutes worth of questions before you get on the phone to Canberra, which we'll be doing a lot these days. It was remiss of me before not to mention the social media going on, of course, at this conference. You can see the login details and the hashtag behind us. I was explaining I wasn't texting or anything, I was tweeting. I should also say that people, we are accepting questions. We're supposed to accept the first question each session by Twitter, but because I haven't said anything, I won't be doing that. Sorry, I'm not sure what you're trying to say to me, Marius. So, do we have any questions? Maybe there's one right at the back from Patrick, so we'll need if you've got ready microphone.
Patrick Heverman, Monash University Faculty of Law. Many interesting issues raised by your talk. There's one that I want to pick up on that connects to your remarks about democracy and participatory citizenship. I've been working in counter-terrorism law for about a bit more than 10 years now, and had quite a bit to do with various agencies and public officials in that time. One recurring motif is an assumption that at least some police and counter-terrorism agencies that all citizens have a duty to accept the foreign policy of the country as it's handed down to them by the government and the agencies that work for the government. And this is, based on my experience, and working with affected communities, a recurring source of friction, a recurring source of objection, a recurring source of a sense of marginalisation. And it's compounded when notions are used, such as a peaceful country, when in fact the country's been at war for the past 15 years in what are very contentious foreign policy matters, whose connection to the democratic reform to national interest is not always clearly articulated and often not even put on the table. What are your thoughts about the connection between democracy and foreign policy?
Thank you so much for your question. And as you were asking your question, my thoughts immediately turned to that very concept or aspect of social cohesion, which is about fostering trust between individuals and institutions. And that includes trust between individuals and the government and the democratic process of government. So I think if we can look at social inclusion social cohesion as not just being this kind of soft side of harmony, and which is often manifest in things like, oh, you know, let's celebrate Australia's multiculturalism by eating Vietnamese food and wearing Arab dress for a day. You know, this very kind of tokenistic appreciation of multiculturalism. If we can actually address social cohesion as a very, more multifaceted way of developing trust between individuals and government, and the way in which government develops policies that impact on individuals, and again, working towards an integrated smart framework where you simultaneously look at the impact of hard measures on soft measures and vice versa. So you look at the impact of laws in counterterrorism, for example, on how that's going to affect soft countering violent extremism measures, and building that kind of trust, inclusivity in the development of policy as well. I think you can start to address that. I don't think it's going to be the complete answer, because at the end of the day, governments will make decisions based on the process of government decision making. I do believe, however, that there is a lot more room for a more inclusive way of developing policy, addressing that very aspect of social cohesion.
Question down the front here. You may actually have two questions at a time. There's one there and then there's one there.
Is there any country in the world at all that you think is an example of, no place is perfect, but an example of really trying to get that balance right between the hard power and the soft power measures? And if there is, why do you think that it's happening in that particular country? And could it also be related to the particular democratic model that's in place?
Sure. I've done a lot of traveling around here is going to be nothing compared to what I've done in the past. And I can't say that I've seen any country that's got it right. I think this, you know, I think this integration of a smart, this integrated smart framework that has that balance of hard and soft is something that some countries are aspiring to and moving towards, but I don't think any country's got it right yet. I think there are examples of good practice around the world, and this is why I think Australia is in such a fortunate position, because unlike many other Western countries, we have not experienced a significant terrorist attack on our soil. We haven't had a lot of experience with violent extremist groups. Whereas if you look at somewhere like Germany, they've had a neo-Nazi movements for quite some time. If you look at Spain, they've got the Basque separatists that had to deal with that for some time. So other countries have had, I guess, more experience in moving towards a balance between the hard and soft. Whereas Australia, we're quite new to this, relatively new to this. So we're in a rather fortunate position where we can learn from other countries and pull together all of those examples of good practice and move towards that. But we need to first of all have that vision of wanting to move towards an integrated framework. And I think at some level we've got it, but I don't think we've tweaked it quite as well yet. So it's very much a trial and error type thing as well. But I can't think of any country that I would say has got it perfect, then I might have really high standards.
Peter Gordon, RMIT Global Studies. I'm interested in pursuing this relationship between the hard and soft measures because they seem to be a counter purpose to each other in how you would pursue an integrated model. Social cohesion is a very delicate matter, especially in the time of social change. If we were using parallel to the criminal justice system, you know, you look in Australia, America, United Kingdom, where the criminal justice system has been at edge to creating cohesion in disadvantaged communities. So I really think that needs to be explored more because as the huge resources are put into the hard measures, they actually undermine the soft measures in developing social cohesion.
I agree with you. I completely agree with you there, but I also think as well that the soft measures that have been developed have been developed on assumptions that come from a hard power approach. The assumptions that what the result has been a securitisation of particular groups, and in this case, in specifically Muslim communities. The assumption that by promoting Australian values, you can address this. And I don't know if you'll recall that time when we tried to define Australian values. You know, this ill defined set of Australian values and integration, and even suggestions of the assimilation, which is something we abandoned a long time ago. And I think that was the issue, that we tried to approach the soft measures based on assumptions that come from a hard power approach. And that, I think, is the biggest challenge towards moving towards an integrated framework. I agree with your points about social cohesion, but I also think we haven't really looked at social cohesion other than through this kind of hard power, soft measure lens. I think if we look at social cohesion in terms of building that trust, and particularly that trust, and we've seen with the last election, we've seen the big swing towards independent parties away from the two major parties. And a lot of talk has been around why people are so much more disengaged with politics these days, particularly young people. The disengagement with politics, the distrust of politics, the distrust of government, I think is something that is part of social cohesion and ultimately part of moving towards a more smart, integrated framework.
Thank you. Are there any it's a question of what he has in mind.
Professor Ali, thank you for your talk. I was hoping to ask whether you think there's possibly a tension between the Islamophobic dog whistling by some sectors of the Australian political establishment and the ideological climate that that creates, which is receptive to movements of the far right, and the aims that you put forward for soft power in terms of social cohesion, civic engagement, and a greater community involvement.
Absolutely. And the thing with soft power is that it's not just about government and government agencies, it's about everyone. So it really is vested, soft power is really vested in grassroots and in civil society. And it empowers grassroots and it empowers civil society rather than just vesting the whole power, the whole, you know, discourse and the creation of the narrative and the direction of the narrative with government and with those in power, including those who have power, such as the media. Okay? So if I was to take an example of the recent issue with a media personality talking about banning from immigration. And you often hear, you know, media personalities and some politicians, particularly at this time in Australia's history where we have, it's quite a significant time in Australia's history because we have quite a diverse parliament, diversity of views in parliament, but also diversity of representation in parliament. So it's going to be interesting the next 3 years. But you often hear people get up and say, we're not allowed to talk about this. We're not allowed to talk about this. But all you ever hear is people saying, we're not allowed to talk about this. They keep talking about how they're not allowed to talk about the thing that they're not allowed to talk about. In fact, that's all they talk about. And I'll tell you who's not talking about it. Who's not talking about it are Muslims who don't have a platform to actually talk about it. So you hear a lot of people talking about how we're not allowed to talk about Muslims, and you know, we're just not allowed to talk about it. That's all they do is talk about it. And so I think, you know, it goes around and around in circles, and it stays on this kind of the top skimming of the pond there, where it's all about how we're not allowed to talk about it. And it continues, and this is what I talk about, that we need to move away from this being about competing rights. My right to freedom of expression, my right to free speech. It needs to go deeper than that, because we need to say, right, we will vigorously pursue everybody's rights. This is not a question of competing rights. And if we move it from that discourse, if we move it from that perception that this is about competing rights or competing claims to human rights, I think we can start to be more constructive.
Okay, I think we've got time for one more question, and Mario has it.
Mario Santos, Amnesty International, Victoria, thank you for a great presentation. I was wondering if I could ask a personal question. I don't know whether you would comment on the reasons behind your decision to stand for Parliament and the different role that politicians can play in addressing all these issues as opposed to academics and civil society.
Thank you. It's actually a really pertinent question for my presentation, actually. So last year was probably the busiest year of my career. I'd done a lot of overseas travel. I'd been to the White House. I was invited to speak at the Madrid Policy Dialogue, which was 100 former leaders and men. and then I did a few UN experts meetings and entered the year in Vienna where a UN experts meeting, we started to develop a judicial guideline for member states on the judicial response to terrorism. And, you know, I walked away from that year and coming back to Australia and thinking and knowing that despite all of this talk that was happening, these high policy dialogues, nothing was going to change without political will. So it came to a point where, you know, I've worked on this from the outside for so long, you know, policy development, but I could see the frustration of not having a smart integrated framework that empowered those who work from outside government and work from outside politics to be able to input and develop into this and work towards this integrated smart framework for addressing terrorism, but also could be used for addressing a whole range of issues as well. And in my point of view, this is a good government model as well. So that was actually what influenced my decision to accept the move into politics. I don't know how it's going to go, but at least I'm giving it a go and hopefully can make some difference there. And I must say, I noted this morning I heard that the coordinator for counter-terrorism has been tasked now with looking at how various agencies can be more integrated in looking at the intersectionalities between terrorism, crime, violence, and mental health. I've been asking for that for 2 years. So it's good that it's happened now, but this very much explains why we need to have these kinds of things also outside the bureaucracy, because bureaucracy is cumbersome and slow to respond, while the phenomenon of terrorism is agile and rapidly changing. And so hopefully, I hope I can make some change that way.
Okay, well, we might bring your session to an end. Thank you so much for coming. I mean, you have to be in Canberra very soon for a shadow cabinet being announced. So thank you, and so fun and stuff.
Thank you.